This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who, when we take the time to listen to their stories, we are amazed by the things they did for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price paid for the freedom we enjoy. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, are we in for a story today from 93-year-old Adelano David of Albuquerque, New Mexico, but not from Albuquerque originally, from a small town on the island of Luzon in the Philippines. What was it like growing up in the Philippines in the 1920s and 1930s?
It was quite Americanized because Clark Air Force Base was only about 3 or 4 miles away. And the town had recreation places, and also the population was quite welcome to the Americans. As a matter of fact, one of my cousins married an enlisted man from Clark Air Force Base, and I had access to the golf course, and it was a very nice view of the Zambales Mountains.
And we're going to hear along the way how you would get involved in World War II, how you would escape the Bataan Death March. We've had some survivors on the show, but I don't think I've had anyone who escaped. This is quite a story we're going to hear. And I always ask every veteran, you know, the vast majority of the veterans I talk to grew up in America, and I always ask them about December 7th, 1941. For you, though, I imagine it's December 8th that you remember as a big day where some big things happened where you were.
Yes, the first time that we realized that December 8th happened was we were in San Marcelino, Zambales, with the 3rd Infantry, 31st Division. I was recuperating from malaria, and I was watching a baseball game between one platoon and the other, and a Piper Cub came roaring over the jungle trees and bared down, up and down, and getting our attention, and then we saw him drop a leaflet, and he said Pearl Harbor was bombed that night. We were ordered to evacuate our place, and because we were on the beach defense, we were told to proceed to Bataan December 8th. But we had our troop carriers were really commanded passenger buses, and they had to put covers on the headlights, and somebody had to sit on the hood guiding the trail towards the jungle and then to Bataan.
And I guess I should back up a little bit, because I took you right to December 8th on that side of the dateline when the war started in the Philippines. But obviously, you were already involved. You had joined the Philippine Scouts, serving alongside the American military.
It was not the Scouts. It was what was called the Philippine Army at first, and then it was incorporated into USAFE, or United States Armed Forces of the Far East, by order of Roosevelt, and federalizing everything concerning pay and benefits. We became U.S. Army of the Far East, USAFE.
And how old were you when you got involved with that?
I just turned 20.
So this was just a few months before the war started. Did you think a war was coming?
I was 19, and a few months before, which was July, August, I enlisted. July, MacArthur, we had a general gathering of all the ROTC students of Manila. I would say that we had 4 Ivy League universities with elite ROTCs. I was part of the model company of UST. We were ordered to go to the Rizal Memorial Stadium, which is like a football arena here, to listen to President Quezon, who warned us about the invasion. And he talked about it, and MacArthur came over. He closed his remarks by saying, "Some of you will return to their loved ones covered with glory, but some of you will never return." And that was July 4th, 1941.
So while so many people in America were surprised by what happened, you knew something was coming, and you had already been preparing for what was going to happen. And then, as folks may know, not long after Pearl Harbor was bombed, Clark Field was hit as well. But you guys, as you said, are being transported to Bataan. Were you starting to get a little nervous? Were you concerned about what was happening here?
At first, I took it for granted because, as a boy, I always welcome adventure. And for me, to join the army was not from any patriotism or what. I just wanted the adventure. So when I was in the army, I enjoyed training, and I was training my men. I was a sergeant. To me, it was like another Boy Scout trip to me, because I enjoyed the outdoors and being with boys my age.
When did that change? When did you realize that this time it's not a Boy Scout trip?
When we were ordered from Bataan to meet the Japanese transport in Subic Bay, I was in charge of a F platoon, and I was ordered to take the front trench on the beach. It was the break of dawn when we saw on the horizon Japanese troops, carriers, and destroyers. Suddenly, as the sun came out, six planes in waves of three began to bomb our place. And I think they were harassed by cannons from Fort Wind and Fort Maribelis, and they could not aim straight. So their bombs fell about 20 yards from my trench, and I just got covered with sand and water. Anyway, to cut a long story short, it lasted about 6 hours. We drove them away, and a thunderous cheer came from our regiment, 33rd Infantry, 31st Division, USAFE. A thunderous cheer came out from everybody because they went away. In the meantime, I had not realized that I was shaking with fear. I could not control my jaw from clacking. I could not control my knees from jumping up and down. And suddenly I found out that I thought I was hit. My leggings were wet, and I was going to call for a paramedic, but luckily I didn't, because I found out it was not blood. I had wet my pants. Wow. Yeah. But anyway, that was December 12th.
The cheers were because they went away, but things would change from there, and you guys would end up in a dire situation. What was the toughest thing that you encountered over the weeks that followed? Because I've heard stories from guys who talk about not having any supplies, not having anything to eat. The weapons they had were not up to date. They had no ammunition. And this was all before the death march started. How desperate did the situation get for you?
Well, it got desperate when, after repulsing several attempts for them to get our area, we were starving for at least 2 or 3 days. Not enough water, and sometimes just a bowl of rice. But even that was not coming because of combat. And then our General King and some of our leaders asked MacArthur to send us a share from Corregidor of their food, because they were having good supplies like pancake for breakfast and ice cream for dessert. And here we were starving with a bowl of rice, and we were refused. That was the most horrifying thing that we encountered. And I don't know what his motivation was, but he was a general, and we accepted it. And what happened then, suddenly the order was out of this world. He was ordering us like to stand our ground, like the Texas Alamo. Remember the Alamo? We were to stand our ground, and luckily, we had a sense of humor. Some of us said, never mind, said, because Superman is coming.
You had to hope in something, I guess, huh?
We had to hope in something, Green Lantern, Captain Marvel. In the trench, you either get your fear or you get to bed shaking and paralyzed.
Before we go further, I'm curious, as a Filipino serving in the American Armed Forces, did you feel that you were treated the same way as anyone else, or did you feel that there was a different way that they looked at you guys because you weren't from the U.S.?
From research that I've looked at in history books, there was some discrimination. We were called gooks and flimps and monkeys. And whenever there was an engagement where Filipinos died by the hundreds, we were never given credit. It was always MacArthur. Of course, to give credit to MacArthur, he never gave credit to his American men either.
What about you personally? Did you feel discrimination, or were the guys you served with treating you the same as anyone else?
I was treated very well because I was a university graduate. So probably that's the difference. But actually, there was no discrimination in my company. As a matter of fact, a Texas lieutenant died for me because I was going on patrol one day, but because the previous day I was on patrol, he said, never mind, I'll take this patrol. He was supposed to return after 2 or 3 days patrolling, looking for snipers. He never returned, so we found his body in the sugarcane field a week later.
I imagine that's a humbling experience and gets your attention a little bit. Before we get to the surrender, can you give us a sense of what the conditions were like? What kind of ammunition, artillery, weapons that you had? I mean, did you feel that you were underprepared, or how did you feel about that?
We were grossly underprepared. Our rifles were too large for the Filipino. To sight the barrel, we had to put the heavy stock on our shoulders, and every time we fired, it bruised our shoulders. And most of the time, because the equipment came from World War I, some of them probably were not properly cleaned, or they were just obsolete. They exploded in our faces, and we had casualties. So the first engagement against the Japanese was a fiasco because we had exploding bombs, rifles. Our machine gun and mortar shells didn't explode. They were duds. So against a veteran army, and really... from Nanking and from Manchuria, and most of our men were farmers and clerks, and some of us didn't even know how to handle a rifle. So we had to retreat from the beach defense to Agno River on North Luzon while we didn't have any more air cover. We lost 350 scouts on the first engagement in Agno River out of 800 because they... on horseback, they fought against tanks.
And these are the stories so many people are unaware of, and I'm so thankful we have you to clue us in a little bit. Were there rumblings of the surrender before it happened, before General King said, yep, this is it?
No, it was a total surprise. Well, most of us cried because we didn't want to surrender. And then when the order came to surrender, a lot of us were still fighting. In spite of the order to surrender, they were bombing us anyway. We were on the last defense on Mount Samat. We lost practically all of our 33rd Infantry was wiped out on Samat. And when I came to me to surrender, I had a choice of going into the mountains because there was a rumor that we could go instead of surrendering. But we couldn't because if we surrendered, anybody who surrendered was shot anyway. They had orders to kill all prisoners. As a matter of fact, there's a record in the books which says the first surrenderers were about 300 mixed U.S. Army and the Philippine Army. They were massacred, 300 of them, and they had surrendered.
I can't imagine what that feels like to be in a situation where you have to make that decision. And you had family to worry about too, right?
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was waiting, and I didn't know where she was. She didn't know where I was. My father didn't even know I was in the army because I didn't tell him.
What do you think led you to decide what you decided? And how scary and frightening was that?
We decided to surrender because if we went to the mountains, we were blocked anyway, and we could be captured anyway. But when we surrendered, a lot of us went away to the hills, including Colonel Torpy, who became the guerrilla leader in Zambales Mountains. When I escaped from the death march, that's what I joined.
Well, isn't that a great way to enter our first commercial break? We'll discuss the Bataan Death March when we come back, hearing firsthand from a man who was on it and escaped it. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.